All right, welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the lifeguard that rescues our resident economist, Eric Mason, when he ventures too far into the deep end, and today we're finally making good on a 200-year-old request to remember the ladies. If anybody's wondering why there's a delay in this episode, we had hoped to include another guest, but we just couldn't get the schedules to line up. And unfortunately, we'll probably need about another 100,000 of you all listening to make this a full-time job, so please start telling all your friends. Eric, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good, sir. How are you doing? I'm very happy to talk about Abby.
We record these things in like bunches on Saturdays, and it's been a couple weeks since we got to record one. Is everything going all right with you?
Yeah, everything's going good. You know, a couple people a little under the weather, just a little bit of busy schedule, but besides that, you know, we're doing well.
I know you're in government. I was getting a little worried for you.
Doge hasn't knocked on the door yet, fortunately. Yeah, okay. Unlike the federal government, I have to have a balanced budget.
Yep. I figured they'd be tapping you to make some pointers.
Right, terrifying. Right?
Well, enough about you. Let's tell me a little bit more about our special topic today, our special guest today. Our focus?
Our focus, yes. I very much like the background on your side. I was there when that statue got made, the beautiful Abigail Adams statue in Quincy, Massachusetts. That sits about, 60 feet from her final resting spot with her husband, John.
Yep.
So fun fact about that statue, that's made, the gentleman who made that statue is also the one who did the Eisenhower statue in D.C.
Really?
Yeah. A gentleman named Sergei, very, very talented sculptor. Hmm. Sculptor, yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. Obviously I'm very biased, and I want to start off just saying I am crazy biased about Abigail. I drive by her childhood home every day when I drive home from work from Weymouth. She was born in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Now it's another fun.
Oh, wait, her home is still available to tour. I think because we went through like the Adams estates and all those, but I didn't know that she had a place that we could visit.
Yeah, so it's in the Old North Cemetery in Weymouth, which also shares another very famous resident, a very famous historical figure, which is Watson of the telephone fame, is buried there.
Oh,
yeah, because
okay. Not Sherlock Holmes is Watson.
No, not Sherlock Holmes Watson, but the first person to receive a telephone call, and a pioneer of fiber optics, believe it or not. He also did a lot of stuff with wireless communications that he doesn't get enough credit for. And founded the Bethel Steel Shipyard in Quincy and Weymouth, which made pretty much any famous battleship you could think of. USS Nevada, the USS Lexington, which obviously wasn't a battleship, it was an aircraft carrier, were all made there. And that was Watson's brainchild. And then he was buried, he's 100 yards from where Abigail Adams grew up. A lot of condensed history around here.
Right.
Brought to you by the Massachusetts Tourism Board. No,
have we gotten their sponsorship yet?
This is us or don't. We're from Massachusetts. We don't like people.
Right. We don't care. We don't care.
You think this is our economy? Yeah, kids over at MIT invented the internet. All right. Sorry.
Why are we talking about Abigail Adams on a four-part episode arc that's supposed to be talking about the second president of the United States?
Because I think she would have made a better president than her husband, but I don't agree with that because I love John Adams. Would have been a better president than Jefferson. I'm willing to argue that.
I think, I don't know anybody who'd fight you on that one.
She wouldn't have passed the Embargo Act. She wouldn't have crippled all of America's trade. That would not happen.
No. We learned about this on the tour, one of the tours, but she started an import business, actually. So, yeah, she would not have signed that because it would have messed with her China import business.
Yeah, she's just awesome. Very famously said to, everybody, you just quoted earlier, Kyle, remember the ladies. And if you read that full quote, or that full, I won't read the full quote, I won't bore you guys, but the full part of that is she says that basically she doesn't believe the laws of the United States should apply to her if they're not remembered in the writing of the Declaration of Independence. Constitutions.
It still said all men are created equal in there. I noticed that he didn't do a great job of remembering.
Generally, well, agreed. Agreed. I gotta imagine that was probably an awkward conversation when old Johnny got home. Like, hey, so like, she has like the paper, so I'm just reading this. But no, she was fascinating. So she was from the aristocracy. She's from the Quincy family, John Quincy, not John Quincy Adams, John Quincy is where the name comes from, Captain Quincy. By the way, he was a captain. His name is Captain Quincy. Sounds like a great mascot. That's a
good name. Oh. It's like Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah. Like, just top tier. So she's the one where actually it's, you know, it's funny. You think with the presidents being from Quincy, which at the time was Braintree, but never forget, they voted to secede from Braintree to form their own city. Because we were part of Dorchester. So, you know, she grows up in this incredibly wealthy family. And what's funny is that, you know, a lot of the founding fathers, they married into wealth, like Washington did. I mean, obviously, Jefferson was already fairly wealthy before. And you know, we're going to, you know, coming up soon, it's going to be Madison. And Madison comes from a wealthy family. But John Adams, as we talked about, wasn't from a wealthy family. Like, he was just, you know, preachers, shoemakers, and, you know, from you know, just that type of lifestyle, right? Abby was, you know, she was that family, and that family wasn't just influential when prior to her being born in late 1600s and into the 1700s, you know, and then Abby's born. I mean, they existed. Boylston Street. She's cousins of the Boylstons. She's cousins to like every major trader in the United States who, you know, dominated the early American economy for honestly the first like 80 years up until the Civil War. And some of them even extended beyond that. But, you know, she was the founding, you know, she's a founding mother who didn't own slaves. Her wealth didn't come from slavery.
It
came from good, fastidious trade with other countries and, well, in good education, not off the backs of indentured and enslaved people. So everything we're going to talk about, her building her wealth, I don't need to do the asterisk I had to do with Jefferson.
Right.
Just like...
She did it through just really smart business sense. Like, you look at some of the things that she implemented, some of the ways she made that farm like way more profitable than it should have been. This is something that Laura wanted me to even mention here, is just about like the processing of the farm products. Like, was she the first person to really recognize like the value add that you can get by making apple butter or whatever like products out of the stuff that you're growing?
Yeah. So yeah, she had this, you know, she was an incredibly well-educated person. Not just, I don't even want to say for the time, a well-educated woman, but she's a very, very well-educated person. And yeah, she understood the idea of early industrialization. So when you talk about, it is funny to think about as the United States was going through its, you know, I don't want to say the American Revolution, Industrial Revolution was going on at this point, because it wasn't. That'd be a mischaracterization.
Yeah.
But it's important to remember that Abigail had been over in England, that she had been, you know, we talked, I don't know if the Jefferson episode has come out yet, but we talked about Polly.
It has, yeah.
Right. Like, her taking care of Polly in England. And, yeah, so she had seen what the Industrial Revolution was looking like. So I think you take a very, very intelligent person, and they see these value-added processes, right? Well, suddenly, it's not too hard to, you know, take, oh, maybe I can make apple butter, and that's going to sell at a higher per-unit investment. And but it wasn't just the production. How do I make things more valuable? She invested just in more real estate that you can still see today, that you can literally Peacefield. You can go walk around it and, you know, see where, you know, Abigail grew all her stuff. They still have a greenhouse there that they grow stuff that's like lineaged from when Abigail and John lived there. So yeah, you know, she did that. She did these value add increases that she did a lot of would be decades later until the American Revolution, the American Industrial Revolution would take off in the U.S. a little north of Quincy, but over in Lowell, Massachusetts, where it kicked off.
Anybody copying her at that time? That's the part that I don't understand. Like, you'd think that once you see somebody do it and start making a lot of money off of it, like, you don't try to like go mimic that. Like,
yeah, you know, part of it is I don't, you know, in that area at the time, we're still very, you know, that was still a very heavy agrarian-based place, but relative to the rest of the country, you know, that area of Massachusetts is already modernizing pretty quick. So I don't know if it was seen as, you know, it's one of those things where you have a group of aristocrats who want their kids to become lawyers and traders and stuff like that. Those are the people with enough money to invest in the scale of machinery needed to make apple butter. So Could they've seen it as beneath?
Yeah. It makes sense.
But one of the cool things is that she's invested all this real estate and property investments. And John's not around during this. John's
right
defending British officers. He's helping draft the Declaration of Independence. He's on the Committee of Five, the Declaration of Independence.
Was he in France for a period of this time, too?
Yeah, France and Spain. There's a random town in Spain that has just a bust of John Adams in the middle of this courtyard.
I love that.
It's in Bilbao, B-I-L-B-A-O, Spain. It's just a bronze statue, and I'll drop it over. It's one of those fun things where it's one of those funny things where everybody from like Quincy who visits Spain is like, I go see the John Adams statue.
Right. Nobody else knows about it.
No, we're really, really, really excited about it. There's no great story behind it. It's not like he saved that Spanish colony or that Spanish city at some point. Nope. He just visited on his way like to France. And so they're like, look, the statue of him. And I'm in.
That's probably the best statue he has.
Oh, no. The best statue he has is that image right behind you. You go slightly like 30 degrees to the left.
Oh, hold on. Wait,
also made by
the left. No, that's right. Nope.
Sorry. I can't see it. So like she's looking. Abigail in your background is looking at John Adams statue. Yeah, it is a good statue. Ooh, it is a good statue of him.
It really is.
I'm a fan of that.
His portrait is... He must have pissed off whoever did his portrait.
Probably. He was like the most mouthiest guy in the world. He definitely probably like just talked bad crap to the guy. So as John Adams is posing for portraits and eventually statues that would be built 240 years after he originally was there. Abigail's left, on the farm. And, if you go visit Peacefield now, I mean, Kyle, you've been there, I've been there. Yeah. Like, it's in the middle of a very, very dense built-up area.
Yeah.
It just is. It's, if you walk across the entire Peacefield, you walk into a gas station. Like, that's kind of how dense it is. And so, as he's off doing this, Abigail's running the estate. And she didn't have a ward or a porter running it. Like, she was the boss. Like, she was doing everything on there. So she's investing in real estate. Now, her and John had, probably the truest, pure, partner-loving relationship of any First Lady and Founding Father. Honestly, between any First Lady and President.
And I'm assuming that this is all from the letters that they've exchanged, which I think you can actually get a publication of, Greg?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're available. The Boston Public Library has a ton of them. Library of Congress has a ton of them. But they read, love letters. Like, they joke. They make fun of each other in the letters. But he trusted her to make business decisions, which was... This is in 1770, 1780s. Like, women aren't even seen as citizens at this point. They're not even seen as equals in government. And you have the most powerful man in the country. Like, oh, my wife's awesome. She knows what the hell's going on. I'm going to ask her for her advice.
She's been doing it for 80 years. She's the one who had the money that I married into. Like, why? Yeah. Tell her how to run it.
But I mean, it's crazy because, these people, it was during a time period where women were seen as, second-class citizens and weren't seen as equals. You got the most powerful man in the world, writing letters to his wife, asking her political opinions, letting her just run the estate, make investments, use the money. Like they were such a true partnership. And it wasn't just a partnership of convenience. Like, they loved each other. Like, you read those letters, and you're just like, wow. Like, John Adams gets this reputation of being, a curmudgeon. And man, he was a curmudgeon. Mm-hmm. Like, as much as he's literally, I would argue, one of the most influential humans ever to live, let alone just an American. He was a curmudgeon, man. He believed that he was ready. He didn't care how many people. He always, he has a lot of quotes that essentially have the effect of saying, it doesn't matter how many people disagree with you. If you're right, you're right. Tyranny by the majority, right?
Which is also why the vice president has no power.
Has no power, yes, because of John Adams. I mean, that's pretty cool that you get into office and you make it so miserable to deal with that you immediately just,
they just completely nerf your position.
Right, because they just drafted the Constitution. Just finished, ink gets dried, and they're like, whoop, we messed up that one.
No, we cannot have another 4 years of this.
Yes. So he's doing... So he's out there, you know, helping to found the United States of America, and you know, Abigail's back home. And again, you know, there's no porter, there's no headmaster. Like, she's running it herself. She hires people, she fires people, she makes investments. And the Revolutionary War breaks out. And she, very smart, starts taking, starts buying Revolutionary War bonds. But she was very, it was very interesting. She was buying bonds on the primary market because she believed in supporting the new nation. But she also started buying bonds on the secondary market.
Probably because she's getting probably a better deal on that, I'm guessing.
Yes, because basically
nobody believed that America's going to win that war.
We didn't believe that. Yeah, yeah. Nobody believed they were going to win. There was a great, I saw a great stat, not a great stat, but a great like header on SportsCenter. And they were like biggest upsets in history. And one of them was like when the New England Patriots beat the St. Louis Rams back in the 2001 Super Bowl. And underneath it, it was the colonists versus Great Britain, 1776. Right. Their dog victories. She believed in the Constitution, like not the Constitution, obviously there was no Constitution at the time that she was buying Revolutionary bonds, but the idea is that it would become the Constitution, the idea of the American Republic. And so she was investing in it both as like what we call an activist investor today, but she was also investing in it because she believed that people were discounting the bonds too great in the secondary market. And I don't know.
So she was looking at things from like a market efficiency type standpoint, thinking that, oh, there's a exploitable edge here.
Oh yeah,
I love this woman.
Yeah, Abigail Adams, is one of those people where everybody, there's a lot, like, obviously grown up in Quincy, like, you know, we have a huge veneration for Abby, but like, is one of those people, especially, you know, living in part of the country, that once you find out about her, you start reading about her, you're like, oh my god, this is literally one of the greatest Americans ever. Like, everything about her life is awesome. Right. Like, she just, it's like, nonstop, just her being like this. Like, it's cool because she's a super independent woman who's, but she's also like, she has a partner to her husband who's the president. And she, like, she's opinionated, but she's super well educated. So, like, she's smarter than, like, she's smarter than 90% of Congress by the time Adams takes over. Like, she's alive today. She's the first woman president, not even close. Like, she's, I think you would not see another, I don't know if we ever see another as influential first lady. I think Eleanor Roosevelt gives her a good run for her money. But it's really, I think, you know, I love Dolly Madison, obviously Louisa Catherine and all those, but they were very, you know, they were very influential first ladies. Jackie O, very influential first ladies, but they were hostess of the nation. Which is important. That is very important. And when we talk about Madison, it's really important. Dolly was incredibly important to Madison's success. Like, comically. It's one of those things where everybody's like, oh no, Dolly Madison gets her fair shake, you know, with how important she was in Madison. It's like, no, she didn't. Like, no matter what, she still doesn't get enough credit. So she was, so she gets into this idea of buying, like, secondary market war bonds, which one, I want to just throw something out here. This is a very, you know, wealth concentrated, this at this point in time, there's a lot of wealth concentration in the United States. We call them Gini coefficients in economics. Like, wealth is concentrated very highly. So not only is Abigail Adams helping, like, by buying primary war bonds, not only is she helping her estate by buying war bonds at a discount, she's also providing back a secondary market liquidity to the immediate area, which is...
It makes this such an amazing decision on her part to go into the secondary market, in my opinion, is that if the Revolutionary War went the way of the British, she probably doesn't have an estate to worry about anyway.
Right.
So there's only one good outcome for her, and you might as well put your money into the one good outcome and make sure that that outcome is going to be even better if it actually hits.
Yeah.
Because if the British win that war, you're not worried about Peacefield anymore. You're not worried about those bonds. You're worried about where your next meal is coming from, because I'm pretty sure the British are going to have a few words to say to you.
Yeah, I've always been curious what would happen. So there was a great historian I was reading. He published a paper. God, it was a long time ago. It was probably like high school. Who said they wouldn't have executed Benjamin Franklin because he's like, this is a national celebrity, right? I often wonder what they would have done with Adams, because he did defend.
He's hateable enough.
What is that?
He's hateable enough, though, that you'd probably get some people behind.
that would really go against him. Yeah, but I'm just like, he wasn't a military leader, and he wasn't a he defended the Brits at the Boss right. Massacre. I wonder if they would have been like, oh, this is just a man who very much believes in John Locke. Like, this is a man who just believes in republics. No one, Adams, though, you're right. He would have said something to somebody. He would have mouthed off to somebody. Yeah, he would have.
Right at the surrender line. Like, not my king.
I know, but that's like what he would have said. But here's where it gets more interesting. I don't want to say Abigail Adams America's first day trader, but she probably would have been hanging out a little more with the crypto bureaus than the institutional investors. And the reason I say that is that she did crazy currency speculation and debt.
What?
And yeah. So, okay. So this is kind of cool. By the way, just so people know, like, we're going to get into Abigail Adams as a person outside of her awesome, like, obviously this is an economic-focused history podcast, so we're leading with that. Oh, but don't worry, everything that you think is cool about Abigail Adams being progressive in the front end in investment, no, she's just as awesome in her personal life, if we get more into that. But, yeah, so continental currency was, and I have some continental currency lying around somewhere in my office here. Huh. Oh, yeah, it's so crappily made. It's just like, you could breathe on it, it would dissolve. So, basically, they didn't have access to sterling, so they were like, all right, we're going to start printing our own. Now, there was, colonial money. There was local currency. In fact, Massachusetts still has the oldest local currency that's still used in the United States.
There was no centralized currency at this point, right? Every state kind of had their own.
Correct. And there was still, like, pound sterling and stuff like that that was usable. But
that was probably more valuable than the local currencies, I would guess. Yeah. If you were trading in pounds, you're probably getting a discounted rate if you're cashing them in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If anybody's curious, the Berkshire buck is still around, the local currency. So Western Massachusetts, Berkshire County. Have you ever seen
it? It's a currency you can actually still, like, cash in?
Oh, yeah, people still, like, businesses take it.
Kind of talk a little bit about the day trading. You started mentioning the currency speculation. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
No, she likes speculative investments. I don't know if she ever. I don't think she ever wrote that down, or if they used that term at the point. But she liked it. And so she started buying all this continental currency in government debt certificates. So just clear, I want to clarify this for. I know, like, a lot of people are all better at finance than me, especially at, like, financial vehicles. A debt certificate would be like a T-bill.
Okay.
A Revolutionary War bond is more like a traditional treasury bond. Debt certificates really
can't... So it's like paying a coupon rate, kind of?
Yeah, exactly, buddy. So the debt certificate was a lot shorter in duration. It was much more malleable. Like, you could trade it. Not that you would normally trade it. I mean, at this point, we're past, a barter-based economy, but we're not... We still don't have the idea of currency, and we're really not going to see the idea of currency until Washington becomes president. And we're not going to see the idea of uniform national currency until the founding of the second national bank under Madison. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until really 1816 that the U.S. had a standard currency that you could look at. So she starts buying these debt certificates and in this colonial currency way below face value. Now, part of the reason it's below face value is the government at the time was practicing seigniorage, so it was printing money to pay bills. If you ever wonder why the U.S. Has huge government deficits, but we have inflation lower than European nations that don't have deficits, it's because the U.S. government doesn't practice seigniorage, so they don't actually print more money to pay bills. They borrow money, and that's why we always have debt cap talks. So at this point in time, the U.S. isn't doing that. It's printing money. It's printing continental currency. It's selling debt certificates to people, and they start losing their value pretty quick because people are nobody really wants to trade these. They're not really working that well. They're really only a function because they really lost access to a lot of British currency and British banks at this time. Now, it's important to remember that New England was never conquered during the Revolutionary War. The Brits are Henry Knox and his cannons push out the Brits. You have the Battle of Bunker Hill, and then the Brits kind of just abandoned Boston. It's Evacuation Day, which is still a day that every kid who lives in Boston gets off.
What is Evacuation? I never heard of this one.
Yeah, Evacuation Day. It's... I think it falls usually on Patriots Day, but being from Massachusetts. We have to call it something different. Do you guys get Patriots Day off?
I never heard of Patriots Day.
You guys know what Patriots Day? March 17th is Evacuation Day.
That's St. Patrick's Day.
That is also St. Patrick's Day.
No, you don't get to co-op a holiday and pretend like it's your own.
Why? Hold on a second. The thing right below it is, why is Evacuation Day celebrated on the same day as St. Patrick's Day? It's just a coincidence. I don't believe that.
Yeah,
Patriots Day. See, you know, it's funny. I love having, I love that I went to school in a different part of the country. That's so different than where I grew up, because I would always talk about Patriots Day. Going to school in the South, or I guess, I don't know, people consider West Virginia the South. I consider everything literally below New York.
Anything below Virginia, I think, is.
Yeah, so I got an argument there. I always say West Virginia's in the South because it's below the Mason-Dixon line, and I don't know if that,
that's true. The standard definition. Oh, you don't know if that's even true. We should probably look that up, huh?
Yeah, I feel like I want to get fact-checked on that. So this area isn't taken over at the time. Like, there's no British management. They're not holding this area. So it's not having any sort of, tangential support. It's not coming from England and propping up the financial industries, right?
Now, we did kind of talk about Bunker Hill for a minute there, about, the battle there. You said that the Brits got pushed out. Like, Bunker Hill is kind of, maybe the only battle that really happened in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War. Is that some?
Yeah, you had the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the Battle of Reed's Hill, which is actually where most of the Battle of Bunker Hill. When we talk about the Battle of Bunker Hill, most of it took place on Reed's Hill.
Gotcha, okay.
Battle of Bunker Hill.
What I find really interesting, Abigail was the one, basically, who I think most of the information we have about the Bunker Hill comes from her journals on that, right?
Yeah, so she took she took John Quincy over to watch the battle.
Oh, Little John?
Yeah.
President number 6?
President number 6, yeah. took him over to watch the battle. And, she was a patriot, too. I want to keep iterating this. She is just one of the most, if you were to make a stat sheet of, intelligence, patriotism, and pragmatism, she's a 10 across the board on all those.
Right.
So she watched it, took a lot of notes. But after the Battle of Bunker Hill and the evacuation we see of the Brits out of New England, it's done. Boston doesn't really ever again come under the influence of another body besides, the U.S. government. So continental currency collapses and there's no alternative for it. So she starts buying this. And I think this is really funny. So obviously she was aware of and understood Alexander Hamilton's long-term plan for the U.S. government. And, this is in the 1770s. Hamilton doesn't get any sort of power until the late 1780s. And so she was buying up all these debt certificates and all this continental currency. Because she was like, I bet the system that Alexander Hamilton's going to put in here is going to make currency really, really valuable.
You think she was betting on that? Or you think she maybe had a little bit more knowledge about, maybe Washington's plan to assume all of state's debts while she was out there buying all the debt?
Well, I think there's a 12-year time gap between those two things. So I don't think Washington ever talked about assuming debt, until he assumed it when he got in there with Hamilton. And even if it is a little bit of I won't call it insider trading, but a little bit of insider trading on her half, so it's still a bet. I mean, you're currently fighting the world's largest military. Yeah. and in fairness, Hamilton was publicly saying all this.
Yeah.
And people were like, why is this Caribbean guy yelling at me about money liquidity?
We need to do a special on Hamilton. I didn't realize how popular he was in Boston.
Dude, he's just
hilarious. It's like your patron saint almost now at this point.
So even though she's providing the secondary market liquidity for people who hold war bonds, she's also loaning money out at interest. So at first, when the war's going on, their state had already done this, and she was seen as very, very, very fair, almost generous in the little amount of interest she would
trying to cripple people.
No.
And
I think what's funny is we know from the Jefferson episode, from the Louisiana land, the Louisiana Purchase side, when we did that. Right now, you're looking at about 8%. 8% was about the coupon rate that England, the U.S. paid after it got established in interest on the bonds it used to buy the Louisiana Purchase. So they think, we don't really know exactly how much she was charging for interest, but we knew it was very fair. So I think trying to like put it in perspective, she was probably charging less than 8% interest.
Probably somewhere in like that 6 to 7% range.
Yeah, which is like, is that like a mortgage now?
Yeah, now it is.
Yeah, not bad.
It used to be.
All right. And it was funny because she also viewed this as an, kind of an obligation she had to the community around her. And yeah, it helped stimulate that economy, the economy just south of Boston. And it was what also made it really interesting is you would also lend money like in really, really, really short durations. Mm-hmm. But you would like assess like their credit worthiness. Like, she wasn't just like just giving, it wasn't like a blank interest rate. She would like meet with you. And I don't know if, like, I don't want to say like she met with you, but she would like, what's your business idea? How much do you need? What duration do you need? And then she would like take all of that, create like a risk portfolio, and lend money at an interest rate associated with that. She was shark tanking like the 1780s.
Did she have her like process? Like, could we go see like the tables that she punched all that into? Like, how she came to those figures?
So I've been able to find any primary sources with those tables. A lot of it's just like secondary letters talking about it. And her kind of not, she wrote a lot of investment. She gave a lot of investment advice to her family. So a lot of that is in those letters. Like her talking like, you know, how to be, you know, a good fiduciary, trying to make good decisions. She would also basically tell everybody to just buy land and government bonds. Like, she was against people speculating who didn't know how to speculate. Oh,
yeah,
yes. Not only is Abigail Adams, like, a great finance mind, she's also not the person trying to sell you some crazy financial investment plan at 3:30 in the morning on CNN.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like not only did she save the Adams estate, it sounds like she also saved a lot of other estates in Boston as well. Fair lending of money during a trying time like that.
Yeah.
That's kind of important.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of like, you know, wrapping up her financial, you know, her financial economic influence before we get into her as a person is she was like a huge advocate of women's financial independence. She basically said there is no true financial, there's no independence of women unless they're financially independent.
So smart.
And one of my favorite things is that she would like write to Adams about this. And not like Adams had any, I mean, that's a societarial thing. Like Adams can't like make a decree like that. And some of the letters, she's like kind of yelling at him. That's what it comes off. Like,
right.
And John's like, hey, I agree with you. I'm not like,
same team.
And I just imagine her hearing some offhanded comment and be like, I'm writing husband president or husband statesman. How about you? But yeah, it secured, you know, it secured the wealth of the family for pretty much forever. And like, even 100 years later, they were still very wealthy. They founded the Adams Academy, which was still exists today. Like the building you can still go to; it's where the historic society is. There's still trusts in place left by the Adams to provide education to people, and that's not from John.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Abigail. That is Abigail Adams doing that.
100%. Everything that exists in the Adams estate today is because of Abigail.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, look at all the other founding fathers. They don't have estates because they didn't have an abbey.
No. So, did we mess up by giving Adams the 3 episodes and then Abigail the 1? Like, should we have inverted that, do you think?
We should do an entire podcast series that is just us comparing Abigail Adams to other famous people and being like, wow, look how crappy they are compared to
her. I actually do want to do an episode on just the revolutionary women in general.
Yes, we should, yes.
And I'd even make that a multi-part one if we need to.
Yeah, we absolutely should, because one of my favorite things about Abigail was how she would write her John Adams' letters are hilarious to read, because they would John Adams used to use like famous literary characters to refer to Abigail. So she called like my dear Diana or my Portia, which is Brutus's wife. The loyal wife of Brutus from Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
She was really funny. She was the one that got John Adams and Thomas Jefferson talking again.
Oh, see? Okay, hang on. What happened between the two of them, because they were good friends for a long time, like, and then it seemed like they weren't friends for a while, and then it does sound like Abigail was kind of the one that brought them back together again.
Yeah, so...
And even Abigail seemed like she hated him for a period of time, too.
Yeah, she hated how much he undermined it, her husband.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, I mean, he mostly, was...
Okay.
He was, like... Jefferson was a difficult person. Like,
yeah.
Adams was a difficult person, but Adams was difficult because he was very moral. Like, he had, like, no... There was no give or take to him.
Yeah.
Jefferson just was a rich, spoiled brat who didn't like people disagreeing with him because his daddy was rich and he went to a good school.
Yeah.
I wish I was... Like, that is hyper... Like, there's a little hyperbole there, but it's also, like, not
that's
that
pretty,
much.
Sounds pretty close.
Yeah, it's how anybody who can write all men are created equal and then bash slavery in a draft of the Declaration of Independence and expand how many slaves you own from 30 to 600. Like, maybe not be the most... Like, that would infuriate John Adams. Like, yeah. If you're sitting in front of John Adams, like, I believe all people are created equal, and you're just sitting, you're like, really? Really, Tommy? Tommy, what are you talking about? It's like, Tommy, did I hear the story of that you made one of your slaves train another slave to make mac and cheese, and you picked his brother? And then you freed the slave, but you knew that him training his brother would make him have to be your slave forever? Like, what? Right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So you can see how John Adams and Thomas Jefferson probably wouldn't get along great. And they also had very different views on government.
Why did Abigail get along with him then? It was just...
I think Abigail got along with everybody. I think a lot of smart people just loved Abigail because she was, I mean, like, was she as charismatic as some of the other founding mothers? Probably not. But she had her own type of her own type of magnetism, where she was just like one of the smartest people in the room, and she was opinionated, and she loved debating, and people would debate with her and argue with her, and they're like, oh my god, she's insanely smart, like she is. And a lot of those founding fathers at that time loved that. She wasn't a wallflower.
Thank God she was wealthy. Yeah. Otherwise, she may have been burned at the stake.
That was 100 years before. We were
yeah.
That's the other part. Like, not only are you arguing with her, you're arguing with one of the wealthiest families in there. So you can't even like. Ooh, not only is this lady smarter than me, she also has way more money than me, and she made the money. I can't even. Jefferson and Adams, so they had fallen out when Jefferson was Secretary of State under Washington because of the increasing Federalist stance by Adams and Washington. And yeah, Thomas Jefferson, the guy who didn't like the increase in the federal government, you know, the same guy who doubled the size of the country. So, yeah, he didn't like where that was going. Then they had the election of 1800 was horrible. And then then Adams provoked it further with the passing of the Alien Sedition Act, which pretty much only targeted Democratic Republicans, which obviously Jefferson was the founder of. But then the whole thing, putting John Calendar in jail, using that act, because John Calendar is the one who called Adams a hermaphroditical character.
That's right.
That was a part of American history
That happened.
You know what's funny? A lot of people have told me they didn't learn that in school. I distinctly remember learning that.
I never learned that in school.
I think it was so funny. The teacher was just like, we gotta talk about this.
I feel like that should have been taught in every class.
Yeah. Also, being from Quincy, like, they probably really want to explain why those two had fallen out. So,
right.
Over time, time heals a lot of wounds. I think we all know that. I mean, these are people. We talk about this a lot. These are people. Abigail and Jefferson start. I believe Jefferson was the first one to reach out to Abigail. Now there was never a complete pause in letter writing. I want to be clear about that. There's this like myth that it went to zero. Not really. They were still communicating. You got to understand these are still two of the most powerful people in the.
Kind of have to talk.
Yeah, and don't forget, Washington died in 1799. Like, so when you talk about the three most powerful people. Of the the early parts of the nation, it's Jefferson, Adams, and Washington. Washington dies. There's no more of that central figure, and then you collapse into the Federalist and the Democratic Republicans, and then even there's this proto anti-Federalist group that's kind of floating around that never really became a party. It was just very hectic. But they stopped communicating in the form of maybe as pleasant as it used to. So they weren't just disagreeing with each other, now being vindictive. And as much as Jefferson tried to hide behind, you know, his calendar who wrote all those bad things, like, no, you think Abigail Adams with enough foresight buy speculative currency positions is like, do you know what? You're right, Tommy. You're right, you tall blonde hit, strawberry blonde haired man. That wasn't you, even though he's your best friend and you fund all his stuff. So yeah, so they eventually get, and Abigail writes about this in some of her letters about how basically calling them both pig heads. You both like, stop it. You guys founded a nation and you're getting upset with each other. You guys stood together in a war. And you're getting upset because you're, like, mouthing off to each other? She's like, it was almost like, grow up. Like, it was kind of awesome. And, you know, Jefferson always had a really, really soft spot in his heart for
he should have.
For Abigail.
That's what she did with Polly.
Yeah, like, taking care of his daughter. And then she would, the way he wrote letters to her, like, and if Abigail, like, admonished him, he took it to heart. Like, he was like, oh, that's it.
Right.
He'd be like, oh, crap, I did something wrong. And so what started happening is kind of cool. So like Abigail write these letters. They were communicating for years. And she started leaving the ends of the letters empty. And John started writing as like his PSs.
Yeah.
And there's a very funny letter just before they start writing a lot to each other again, where Abigail leaves like half a page and John writes and goes, I forget how words. It's like my dearest oldest friend. He's like, Abigail has finally stopped writing, so I actually have space to write to you. please write to me when you fail well. And I don't know why I like that so much. I just like the idea of him like walking like Abigail sitting at the table.
His wife.
Yeah. And they end up having a beautiful friendship for the last 15-ish years of their life. I also want to throw one more thing to that relationship. I think Madison had a lot to do with that too, because Jefferson viewed Madison as his like protege, and Madison loved Jefferson. He also loved John Adams. John Adams was incredibly good to Madison. When Madison was drafting the Constitution, he constantly communicated with Adams because he basically took the Massachusetts Constitution and remodeled it for the nation. And Adams could not have been more helpful to Madison. And I think Jefferson was like, oh, maybe he doesn't hate me because like this is my protege, you should be mean to him. And instead he's like, oh, what do you need, what can I get you? I think it's very interesting. But no, who would have guessed the smartest person in the story, Abigail Adams, was the one who got the second and third president to get back on the same page.
That's amazing. Man,
now one thing I do want to, I know we're getting towards the end of this, but one of the things I do want to bring up is like a couple really cool little side stories of Abigail Adams that really, I think, paint a picture. There's not too much of them. We don't have that much deep historical record, so we can't really opine on them. But she was often referred to in press as like the unofficial political advisor to the president, the confidant of the president, which some people love, some people hated. She was also the first person to really be the hostess. She's a real first lady in terms of actually taking on what we'd call a first lady. That's no insult to Martha. It just wasn't in Martha.
Martha just seemed a lot more private. I don't think she really wanted anything to do with the spotlight.
Yeah, I have an issue with people who kind of like, I mean, I'm the first guy to say, you know, Martha Washington once sent the army to capture her slave that escaped because she wanted nice dresses. But I also acknowledge that I don't think Martha ever visioned her life becoming what it was. I don't know if she ever planned on being the first lady. She wasn't politically active. But one of my favorite things about Abigail Adams is she would like openly comment to the press and to the public about her opinions on different pieces of legislation. Like,
oh, that's amazing.
Can you imagine the first lady today, like opining on the Federalist Papers?
Right.
Like, that's awesome. And she would be critical of some stuff that her husband was doing.
Probably be saying things that made sense, too.
And she always, it was funny, when she could criticize, she would argue it's a form of public morality. That you should be informed and you should have opinions. That anybody at any time needs to be able to defend why they have an opinion on something. You know, she obviously, I think a lot of her, remember the ladies, you really can't get around that. She did talk about, like, you know, the women's rights movement. Like, is she the first mover of the women's rights movement that, you know, would transcend in through women's suffrage in the early 1900s? There's debate on that.
Should be considered.
Yeah, a lot of people consider her. Some people say, you know, she didn't use her position enough to be as progressive as she could have been. The counter argument to that is, like, the first lady doesn't have political authority. What did you expect her to do?
Like, nobody's defined what this role is. Like, you can't just go out there and start throwing wrenches into everything.
Right off the bat.
You got to see what you can get away with first.
Yeah, and, you know, she, in all her letters, I mean, she's, like, the consummate professional, but also just, like, borderline, like, fervent patriot. Like, mm-hmm. she believes in the United States more than any other. Like, honestly, probably more than some of the people who, who fought in the war.
Think about it from her perspective, or her point of view. Where else is a good place to live as a woman in the world at this time?
Yeah.
There's probably not many places.
Yeah, it's probably literally
a new nation is probably your best bet. Where you're married to the guy who's hopefully, like, writing the documents that maybe can give you something.
Maybe give you something.
Maybe.
It just took 100 years.
Yeah.
It's another, like, 70 years. And one thing as we, you know, kind of come to the end is her personal stance on slavery. She was, I'm not going to know the right adjective, but she was.
Vehemently?
Yeah, like, yeah, vehemently? Yeah, you said that right. Yeah, vehemently.
I think so.
Just ferociously anti-slavery. You couldn't sit in the same room with her not going out of her way to voice her personal convictions and just her moral convictions on this too. She thought it was insane that a country that would value individual liberty and equality had slaves. She just couldn't wrap her brain around it. She would talk to the founding fathers. Anything you probably wish you could say to a founding father who owned slaves and, you know, signed the Declaration of Independence and drafted the Constitution. She said it to them. Like, you can be rest assured that she at one point said stuff to these people. She said stuff to Jefferson. She said stuff to every founding father. You know, she would write letters to her husband saying she would use the word hypocrisy. The persistence of slavery is hypocrisy, was the term. She at some point stopped referring to it as slavery in some letters when she would write to people and just called it human bondage. Like, she would go over the line to make it an abrasive
sound
thing
even
to
worse.
Read.
Yeah. It's funny. Human bondage actually sounds nicer than slavery.
You know, she would write to different social circles all around D.C. Even before that, I mean, some of her letters are as far back as 1774. You know, calling it a sin of this country. Now, that's why it's important to remember. She's this amazing patriot. She's like this, America's the greatest country. She's one of the first people to sign that. And she called it a sin of the country. I think it's rare to find anybody that early who is just that.
Patriotic, but yet still willing to criticize the thing that they love so much.
Well, I do really like one thing. She got in a lot of trouble for this when... in D.C. and stuff like that, when she was at her estates in Quincy, she was known for any African Americans who came into the house welcoming them mm-hmm. if they were white, and that really ticked off a lot of the social circles, and she carried that pretty much everything she did, but she would intentionally bring up these issues in front of people to force them to talk about it. In one case, Abigail hired a freed black servant named James. And James once went to her and said, you know, I would like to be educated. He didn't know how to read. He didn't have really, he had no formal education. And Abigail was like, that's awesome. And so not only did she, like, you know, hire tutors and send him to school and stuff like that, she demanded he have the same standard of education as any white child would have. And people would go to Abigail and be like, Abigail, don't you think that's a little taboo? And she would just lay into them. Like,
God,
publicly.
I love this.
She would just lay into them. She would argue. She would argue with anybody. Like, it was wild. Like, but she always argued that, you know, all individuals, regardless of race, had the right to improve themselves through education. And she viewed this concept, and this is a concept we don't see at this time period among the founding fathers. We don't see this. James Madison wanted to, you know, he was a supporter of the founding of the colony of Liberia, like that he, you know, free slaves, but send them back, you know, send them back to Liberia, mm-hmm. which isn't even where a lot of slaves are from.
No,
like, that's not even like.
It's an Iberian, like Spain.
Liberia. Iberia.
Okay.
Spain and Portugal is the Iberians. So yeah. Liberia is right. On the west coast of Spain, of Africa. And so, like, yeah, she was just this, like, really progressive. She was, like, a really progressive lady. And I just love the fact that she, like, would go out of her way. And this is the most Massachusetts, the most Boston. She may be the most Boston woman to ever live, is that she would do these things and then want to get in a fight with you about them. Oh, you don't think all people are created equal? Like, hold on. You stop. Like, can you imagine?
Hold my beer.
Yeah. The richest lady married to the most powerful politician. And you're just like, hey, Abby, you know, you sent in James to the same school as my kid. Yeah, you got a problem with that? Like, oh, no, I'm sorry. No, but no, in ending, I mean, it's hard not to love Abigail Adams, and who I would argue is not the greatest founding mother, not the greatest side character in the founding of this nation. I would argue that she deserves a place as one of the greatest founders of this country.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that. And unfortunately, I think we got to the end of this, but we still have to give our Adams rankings, which I think we're still using the POTUS scale for now. So why don't we rip through that real quick, and then we can put a bow on this thing and get us out the door.
1 to 7 scale, just for the audience?
1 to 7, yep. And I know what your answer is going to be, but we'll go down the list here as a formality here. So political influence.
Now, the rules are, my dear friend, are the rules only of their presidency or of their career?
I have been cheating this as like kind of the whole bulk of their career, not just the presidency.
For Adams, I got to go 7. He wrote the Massachusetts Constitution that became the basis, the civil law. I mean, like,
I don't know that you can give him a full 7, though.
Oh, why is that? Is it the Sedition Act?
No. Well, that's partly an issue. But in order to be a good leader, you got to have people want to follow you. And being cantankerous, I think, kind of puts it makes it a little bit more difficult to get people to do what you want.
So, do you want what's your number?
I just want to knock him just a spot.
Want to go down to 6?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hurts my heart. But
I know. I know. overall governance, the effectiveness of his administration in implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability and governance.
That's a hard one for him. For Mr. Adams. Over his entire career, again, I think this. I'm a structuralist in some sense. Like, I like people who put in that type of infrastructure. But I'd probably say like a 3. And that's very heavy on his.
You give him a 3, even.
Yeah, I'd give him a 3.
Wow, dang, I thought you'd have still fought for at least a 5.
I'm trying to not be a townie. It's impossible, but...
Oh, well, now I want to go back and give you your 7 on political.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, it's negotiated ranking.
Like, hold on, wait a minute. I know you're going to be actually... I thought I was...
No, so that was a real 7 at the beginning, just for the record.
Well, I'm not going to take that away from you. Then. I'm putting that back. If you're going to actually be, you know... what's the word? Unbiased. Okay, transformational leadership then. The president's capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history? 7.
Yeah. I
gotta
mean,
be
like,
right.
If they're negative, does that count? Like the Alien Sedition Act was interesting.
Nope. It does not matter. In fact, I think that's even more impressive if you get a piece of legislation through that's as bad as that, or the Embargo Act, or...
You give, again, like, the heavy weight of his role in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, I mean, it really pulls him through. Also, I mean, they had to throw away part of the Constitution after he became vice president because he was such a loudmouth jerk. 7.
See, that doesn't sound like transformational leadership.
It did transform, just for the worse.
All right, understanding of public needs. How well did he understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the American public? Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
No.
Seems like that's the opposite of what he would do.
Yeah, that's just, he would be like, oh, you have an opinion about something? Is it a well structured argument? It's like, no. Okay, then.
Is your opinion right?
Yeah.
No? Okay.
I feel like you'd be like, do you own slaves? And you'd be like, yeah. And if you said yes, you'd be like, well, your opinion does not matter to me anymore.
Except. I would argue that he's taking into account the feelings of the people that aren't being looked at in that scenario.
Yeah, that is true.
Slaves have opinions and feelings, too.
Yeah. And it would take another generation and his son before they got acknowledged. But I think the answer to that question is probably like a, they'll probably go back to a 3 on that.
I give him a little bit. I give him right in the middle. Give him a 4.
You give him a 5? 4?
4. I give him a 4. Yeah. Strategic vision? Clarity, ambition of his vision for the country? Did he have a forward-thinking approach that guided his decisions and inspire hope for the future?
No, I don't think... I would not call him a visionary president. I would call him a pragmatic president. I don't think he didn't have a view of looking forward. I think he viewed it as the president's... He had a moral compass, and that was to dictate things that would happen of how he was handling them.
Why is pragmaticism not vision?
Well, I think it's... You have to think of what you want the country to look like, as opposed to just simply addressing crises as they pop up. I think he was more the latter.
I got you. Okay.
I think Jefferson actually falls more into the vision, even though I would say he was not a pragmatist.
Well, I mean, you gave Jefferson a 1 last time we did this for this category.
Was it because of the negative side of the Embargo Act? Yeah, it was. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that's why I was surprised you said earlier that negative was okay. I'm like, oh, my, crap, what was my Jefferson's question?
The Embargo Act was so... It just wasn't a good one.
Yeah, the Embargo Act was so stupid.
Yeah,
it was just dumb. Like, it's just like, how about we blow up our economy? That will show them. I'd give him like a 2.
I think he had a vision. It just he probably just didn't have a chance to really implement anything. Like you said, he was. I mean, you're dealing with the death of Washington.
Yeah, right.
The second person on this experiment that really you're just trying to hold things together. I think at this point.
And you have some dude calling you, your character, hermaphroditical?
Yeah. One term.
Yeah, for one term. Yeah, that's right.
One term, too. Do we ding people for not getting reelected, too?
I think we have to a little bit. I've been like, calculating that in here, by the way. Like, when I'm giving my numbers, I'm like, he didn't get reelected.
Okay, so which one does that hurt?
I think vision and Paul, like, the vision side and ability to act. Yeah.
Leadership, I think that one kind of falls under. Maybe we do need to ding it. Leadership down.
Yeah.
6 it is. All right, so we got 7, 3, 6, 4, 2.
7, 6, 3. Oh, you didn't do too bad.
No, and I'd also like to give the wild card aspect, which haven't really been giving the presidents like their wild card trait, but I think boss bitch wife probably fits here in this scenario.
I actually had that written in my notes. I wasn't sure what we do with the swearing because I didn't want to say that, but yeah, having
that word should be okay.
I was gonna say, having literally intellectual pair. You're already the smartest founding father, and I will fight anybody that John Adams is by far the smartest.
And now you're married to this person smarter than you?
Smarter than you. Who's also, like, a financial genius. Yeah, come on. That's huge. Also, I don't know how much it affects it, but I think it would. These are people. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys, the reason they kept their slaves is they were financially insolvent. Adams had a lot of money that wasn't of his making. And it's not like it was just my wife was rich. Nah, his wife was rich, and she made them a lot more money by just good, solid investments.
But then you go, I mean, let's not say that, I don't think Adams would have turned to slavery.
No, no, I don't
think he hadn't met Abigail. I just want to make that clear, too.
No, he wrote a constitution that banned slavery, so I think he was firmly on the other side, but just that financial stress.
I think he would have rather been poor.
Oh, yeah, by far. I don't think Adams really cared about his money. I'm serious. I don't think he wasn't ostentatious. I mean, even his son who grew up, you know, not John Quincy Adams, they were still becoming wealthy when he was growing up. He was one of those dudes, he's like, just like crackers. That was like his favorite meal, just eating like a bunch of crackers.
Oh, crackers are good.
Yeah.
Especially with some smoked oysters.
Yeah, I just imagine he liked to. We'll talk more about it. JQA will be a 85 part series of me covering everything.
All right. Well, I mean, if you're listening here, you probably wish we had another hour too, but we do have a tight schedule to keep. So, unfortunately, that's probably going to have to do it for today. I would think we might have messed up by giving Adams the 3 episodes and Abigail only 1, but we can come back for more. I think we got to get Rick in here to do maybe we'll get him back in another Abigail episode.
Oh, we should talk about the finances more since, you know, Rick's a CFA.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yes, there All we right. go. Yes. All right. If you do want more follow-ups, leave us a comment. Drop us a line at thebuckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. And remember, you can help us game the algorithms by liking, sharing, subscribing to all our content. Visit the website at thebuckstartsherepodcast.com. And we will see you all next week.